Okay, I'll talk about some joint work with Mike Mosca and Lynn Van Dam on adiabatic quantum algorithms. So let me start by saying what these algorithms are. So adiabatic quantum algorithms were introduced by Fahri, Goldstone, Gutmann, and Sipser about 2 years ago. And what these are a new style of programming a quantum computer. It's the adiabatic algorithm is a general purpose heuristic. It has a lot of interesting aspects to it. It's general purpose. It's stated directly in terms of Hamiltonian, so physicists like it. These algorithms are robust, as was shown in a certain sense. Shown by Childs, Fahri, and Preskill recently. And these algorithms have also been introduced in around the same time as the Fahri et al. Article. There was another article which talked about a quantum analog of simulated annealing, where you have an array of quantum bits, and you subject them to a transverse magnetic field. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to find the ground state of this system. Okay, but it's a hard ground state to find. So that's the optimization problem that we are trying to solve. And so you subject it to a large transverse magnetic field in the x direction. So now initially the state of the system is really a uniform superposition. And then you gradually turn down the magnetic field. And the hope is that the system relaxes into its ground state. Okay, so what this paper showed is that even though that for certain problems where classical simulated annealing gets stuck in local optima, that this process tunnels through those local optima towards the global optima. And then there was a paper earlier this year by Fahri et al. Where they published numerical simulations of this algorithm on small instances of Gleek and 3SAT and so on. So these are NP-complete problems which are classically hard. And what they pointed out is that their simulations were consistent, even though these were very small instances, but they said they were consistent with polynomial running times. On the other hand, these algorithms are very hard to analyze, have proved quite hard to analyze rigorously. And so the main question here is just what can we say theoretically about these algorithms? Okay, so before telling you what an adiabatic algorithm is, an n qubit state psi, which is evolving under time-dependent Hamiltonian, well, then you can describe that by the Schrödinger equation. So the Hamiltonian H for the properties that I'll need is that it's Hermitian, that its eigenvalues correspond to the energy of the corresponding eigenstates, and that the eigenstate with minimum eigenvalue we'll call the ground state of this Hamiltonian. Okay, so what the adiabatic algorithm relies on is the quantum adiabatic theorem, which was proved in the early part of the last century by Born and Fock. So what this theorem says is the following. So say that you have some continuously evolving Hamiltonian. And say that you start the system off in the ground state of the initial Hamiltonian H0. Then what this theorem says is that if you perform this transformation from H0 to H1 slowly enough, then the system will track the ground state of the Hamiltonian and will therefore end up in the ground state of the final Hamiltonian. Okay. Now, how slowly you have to do this, perform this transformation, depends upon the eigenvalue gap, the difference between the minimum and the second minimum eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian. And so the amount of delay associated with this process in order to get the ground state of H1 with sufficiently high probability is that the delay should be proportional to 1 over the square of the gap. Okay, so now suppose that, now let's turn to the computational picture. So we are trying to minimize some function f on the n-bit strings. Okay, so it's a it's an integer valued function on the n bit strings, and we are trying to compute, find that x which minimizes f of x. So what we can do is we can write out a ground state, we can write out a Hamiltonian h sub f whose ground state is exactly this minimum value of f of x. So the Hamiltonian will be diagonal in the computational basis or in the z basis, and it's just the sum over all n bit string z of f of z times the projector on z. So the eigenvectors are just the computational basis states with eigenvalues f of z. So clearly, the ground state is that value of z which minimizes f of z. So that's what we're looking for. And then, in order to use the adiabatic theorem, what we have to do is pick h naught to be Hamiltonian with a known ground state. So we'll pick some simple Hamiltonian where the ground state happens to be an equal superposition over all the n-bit strings z. And then the prescription is we start in this initial ground state phi naught, the equal superposition over all n-bit strings. And then we choose a sufficiently large time period. And we apply, at time t, we apply a convex combination of h naught and h sub f. Right? And t is going to control how long the process takes, but we just use a simple interpolation between h naught and h sub f. And so if t is sufficiently large so that the adiabatic theorem applies, then we'll end up with solving this minimization problem. So the only question in analyzing this algorithm lies in computing the minimum eigenvalue gap. Right, the minimum over all tau of this eigenvalue gap. Now, this the adiabatic algorithm is rather a nice algorithm in the following sense, that it's this laid-back algorithm. Right, that it doesn't hurry anywhere. It just takes its time, you know, sure in the knowledge that it's going to get there. And if it actually works well, then it's quite a nice there's a nice moral to this story. Okay. All right. So let's see. Is there any case where this adiabatic algorithm actually works well? So about the simplest case you can look at is this Grover search problem. So here you're given, we are searching through a table which is indexed by the n-bit strings. So there are 2 to the n entries to the table. Each entry is either 0 or 1. And let's say that since we are talking about a minimization problem, suppose that exactly one of these entries is a 0 and all the other entries are 1s. And we're trying to figure out this particular special entry. Okay? So now this corresponds to minimizing the function f sub a, which is given like this. F of a is 0 and f of x is 1 for every x not equal to a. So again, we write out the final Hamiltonian h sub a, which is sum over all n-bit strings x not equal to a of the projector on x. And the ground state of this Hamiltonian is a. And again, we are going to pick some initial Hamiltonian suitably chosen so that, say, the initial ground state is known and is an equal superposition over all the n-bit strings. And then we apply the adiabatic formalism to it. Now, it turns out that if you choose sort of the easiest initial Hamiltonian, then computing the eigenvalues for this particular system, it turns out to effectively be a two-dimensional problem. And so you can compute the eigenvalue gap explicitly as a function of tau. And it's some value as a function of tau. And the minimum gap occurs at tau equal to a half, and it is 1 over square root of 2 to the n. Right? So if we substitute this into the delay factor, then what this tells us is that the delay factor we should use is 2 to the n, which is really exponential search, which is like searching through all the entries of the table. But if you want to get a positive result out of this, we just have to make one observation, which is that which is that g of tau as a function of tau achieves its minimum at tau equal to half. But if you go away from a half, then g of tau increases quite rapidly. And so what we can do is, instead of using a fixed delay factor as a function of tau, we could use a variable delay factor. And so then the actual delay that we need to use, if you use this variable delay factor, is the integral of 1 over g of tau squared, integral of 1 over the gap squared. And for this particular function, it turns out to be square root of 2 to the n. So it matches Grover's band. This was actually also independently proved by Rollin and Cerf earlier this year. Okay, so what this shows is that at least that the adiabatic quantum algorithm is truly quantum mechanical, in the sense that it does give us a quadratic speedup that's not possible classically. So now, what about more complicated optimization problems like 3SAT? In the problem 3SAT, we are given a Boolean formula over n variables, n Boolean variables x1 through xn. And the formula, the value of the formula is the conjunction of m clauses. Okay, so the formula evaluates to true or 1 if and only if each of m clauses, all these m clauses evaluate to 1, and each of these m clauses is an OR of 3 of these variables or the negations. So now, what we are looking for is an assignment to these Boolean variables, which makes the formula evaluate to true. Okay, so to turn this into a minimization problem, we can let little f of x1 through xn be the number of unsatisfied clauses. So when we are looking for a satisfying assignment, equivalently we are looking for an assignment where the number of unsatisfied clauses is 0. So we are minimizing this function. And again, we can write up a Hamiltonian corresponding to this, which is just the sum of f of x times the projector on x. Okay, so at this point, we can, when Eddie Fari talked about this algorithm at KIPP in January of this year, there was a lot of skepticism among the computer scientists that such an algorithm could possibly work in sub-exponential time. And the reason for the skepticism was this. People have studied whether or not quantum computers are likely to solve NP-complete problems in the so-called black box model. So in this black box model, the way you study it is like this. So we say, well, we don't really know what this quantum algorithm looks like, but we'll just look at how it communicates with this function that it's trying to, with the SAT formula. Okay, and let's say that it communicates with the SAT formula as follows, that it makes queries to the SAT formula, and the query is going to be in superposition, and the answer to this query is, the query x is going to be f of x, where f of x says whether or not this formula is satisfiable. And between queries, the quantum algorithm is allowed to make arbitrary unitary transformations. And so one of the early results in quantum computing was that, in fact, any quantum algorithm for this kind of a search problem must make square root of n queries. Square root of n is 2 to the little n over 2. And so this seems to, suggest that any such algorithm must take exponential time. This is, by the way, matched by Grover's upper bound. So now, why is it that adiabatic quantum algorithms are not subject to this sort of a lower bound? So, well, if you look at the queries that this adiabatic quantum algorithm is making, then what it's querying is the number of unsatisfied clauses. It's not just querying whether f is satisfied or not, but also how many clauses are unsatisfied. So at first sight, it looks like a very minor change. But it turns out that if the queries are of this form, where you ask for actually the number of unsatisfied clauses, then you can actually reconstruct the original SAT formula using only and cube queries. And since in this model we are not really counting the amount of time that the algorithm actually uses in solving the problem, we only worry about how it's communicating with the SAT formula. Well, once it knows the SAT formula, it can just solve it, solve the problem in one step. So this kind of lower bound no longer applies in this case. Okay, so I can go over the argument just to show you that it's nothing mysterious, that it's actually quite simple. Okay. It's actually n cubed classically. Okay. So just to demystify this a little bit, let me show you that if the SAT formula happened to be monotone, then you can do this very easily. And if it's not monotone, then it's a little more complicated, but it really follows these same ideas. So a monotone three-SAT formula is one where each clause either contains all unnegated variables or all negated variables, right? And monotone three-SAT is also NP-complete, so it's a hard problem. So now what we'll do initially is we'll ask a query on X where all the Xi's, all the variables are set to 1, right? So in this case, all these positive clauses are going to be satisfied and none of the negative clauses are going to be satisfied. So the answer we'll get is P for the number of satisfied clauses. Now, if we input all X is 0, then the number of satisfied clauses would be N, the number of negative clauses. If we input Xi, you know, all the x is equal to 1 except xi equal to 0, then all the positive clauses will still be satisfied. But now all the negative clauses which contain xi would also be satisfied. So the answer would be p plus n sub I. And from this you can figure out n sub I, the number of clauses, negative clauses which contain the variable x sub I. Okay, similarly you can figure out p sub I, the number of positive clauses which contain x sub I. And then we can query on all x is equal to 1 except x sub I equal to x sub j equal to 0. And now all the positive clauses would be satisfied, but also all those negative clauses which contain either x sub I or x sub j or both, right? And so the number would be p plus n sub I plus n sub j minus n sub ij. And so since we know p, n sub I, n sub j, we can figure out n sub ij. Okay? And so proceeding in this way, we can figure out all the n sub ijk and p sub ijk, which is n, p sub ijk is all the number of clauses, positive clauses, which contain I, j, and k, right? But that's either going to be 0 or 1, depending upon whether this formula contains xi or xj or xk or not, right? So by knowing all these numbers, we can figure out exactly what this formula was. And the number of queries is of course, only n cubed. Okay, so what this argument shows is that there's no a priori reason to believe that adiabatic algorithms will not solve NP-complete problems in polynomial time. Okay, so now we really have to understand how to analyze this gap between the minimum and second minimum eigenvalue to bound the running time. So to figure out this gap, I'll have to tell you the choice of H naught explicitly, the initial Hamiltonian. So remember, the final Hamiltonian was diagonal in the computational basis or the Z basis. The H naught, the initial Hamiltonian, is going to be diagonal in the X basis, and it's just the sum of sigma X applied to the ith bit. Or if you want to write it out explicitly, then it's diagonal in the Hadamard basis, so the projector on the Hadamard transform of X is going to be the Hamming weight of X. So the Hamiltonian is the sum over all n bit strings X of the Hamming weight of X, which is the number of ones in X, times the projector on X hat, which is the Hadamard transform of X. So the ground state of this system is just going to be zero hat, the Hadamard transform of the all zero strings, which is just the uniform superposition over all the n-bit strings. And now what we want to do is study our general Hamiltonian, which is h of tau, and compute its gap. So what we can show is that there are instances of 3-sat for which this minimum gap is exponentially small. And therefore, the delay factor that you need to use is exponentially large. Now, what's probably more interesting than this theorem is really the style of proof, or what it's saying about the adiabatic algorithm. So somehow what the proof says is that so what's hard about minimizing functions, the NP-complete problems, is that they tend to have lots of local minima, and with large basins. And then the global minima tend to have narrow basins. So this is an archetypical function which is hard to minimize, where the global minimum, in order to find it, you have to sort of search in this narrow well rather than being stuck in this wide well. And so the proof that the gap is exponentially small actually follows this outline. So what we show is that we can come up with a 3-sat instance where there happens to be the global minimum happens to be defined in this narrow region, and that in most of the region, if you were to do gradient descent, you'd get down to a local minimum which does not correspond to the solution to the problem. Now, of course, so in order to do this, I've drawn the figure in 2 dimensions. But that really doesn't reflect in any way the topology of the n-bit string. So in order to make sense of this picture, I've got to show you something about the n-bit strings and what their structure is. Okay, let's look at the n-dimensional hypercube. Its vertex set is all the n-bit strings. And we'll say 2 strings, x and y, are adjacent to each other if they differ in only 1 coordinate. Right? We can also put a partial ordering on the n-dimensional hypercube. So we can say that x is less than or equal to y, an n-bit string x is less than or equal to y, if and only if it's each coordinate of x is less than or equal to the corresponding coordinate of y. So for example, 0, 0, 1, 0 is less than or equal to 1, 0, 1, 0. But 0, 0, 1, 0 is not less than or equal to 1, 1, 0, 1. Okay, now this squiggly figure here is my representation of an n-dimensional hypercube. So that's the all zero string, that's the all one string, and the middle level is where most of the mass of the string sit, and so on. Okay, now we'll also say that a function on this hypercube, an integer-valued function on this hypercube, is monotone decreasing, if whenever x is less than or equal to y, f of x is greater than or equal to f of y. So a monotone function is one where most of the weight sits near the bottom of the hypercube, and the top is relatively sparse. So then there's this simple lemma about monotone functions, which will be useful, which says that if you look at a function which is monotone, and if you ask how much of the weight of this function sits on the topmost half minus epsilon n levels of the hypercube, right? So if you look at the sum of f of x for all those x whose Hamming weight is bigger than half plus epsilon n, right? So this top part of the hypercube, and you look at it as a ratio of the sum of f of x, then the claim is that is exponentially small. So that just captures this intuition that most of the weight of the hypercube lies in the middle layers, and if you rule out the middle epsilon n layers, then there's exponentially few points outside, and then if the function is monotone, the top part contains very little weight. So in order to analyze these adiabatic algorithms, what we're going to do is analyze adiabatic algorithms how they behave on monotone functions. Okay, so now we are trying to minimize a function f. We assume that the so at time tau we are applying the Hamiltonian H of tau, which is a convex combination of H naught and H sub f. And the ground state at time tau I'm going to denote by phi of tau, and let that be this particular superposition, sum over x of alpha x. Then the claim that I make is that this ground state at time tau is going to satisfy these conditions, that the amplitudes are positive real numbers. So all the amplitudes of the ground state are positive real numbers. And moreover, if f is monotone, then phi is also monotone. Okay, what this means is, if you're trying to minimize a monotone function, then if you look at phi, the ground state, then if x is less than or equal to y, then the amplitude of x must be greater than or equal to the amplitude of y. So we are starting off initially with this uniform superposition over all the n-bit strings. And as time goes on, if you're trying to minimize a monotone function, then the superposition falls downwards. And eventually, of course, if it's a monotone function we are trying to minimize, the minimum occurs at the all zero string. And so eventually, all the superposition is concentrated on the all zero string. But along the way, the function, the state is always monotone. Okay. Let's see. This is kind of an important point about the in trying to understand these adiabatic quantum algorithms. But I'll skip the proof of this fact for now and come back to it later if there's interest. Okay. So now that we know that the adiabatic algorithm treats monotone functions in this particular way, where the ground state is always monotone, we can now set up a trap for the adiabatic algorithm. So what we'll do is we'll set up a new, so given a monotone function f on the hypercube, we'll set up a new function g which looks like f on most of the hypercube, except that on the topmost half minus epsilon n levels of the hypercube, g is different from f. Okay, so in the lower half plus epsilon n levels of the hypercube, f is equal to g. But although the minimum value of f occurs at the all zero string, we'll choose these topmost levels of g to make sure that the minimum value of g occurs at 1 to the n. Right? So these are, g and f are very different from each other because the minima occur in very different places. Okay? On the other hand, now we'll claim that if we were to run the adiabatic algorithm on g, that the adiabatic algorithm would get completely confused. So the reason it would get confused, we'll reason like this. We'll say, well, suppose you run the adiabatic algorithm on f. Well, then it's tracking the ground state, and the ground state is always monotone. So now suppose we switch functions on it. Suppose instead of using the Hamiltonian H sub f, we use the Hamiltonian H sub g. How differently will the algorithm behave? Well, since the ground state is monotone, most of the weight of the ground state lies in this bottom part of the hypercube, right? Only the part of the superposition which sits in the top part of the hypercube will notice the difference. But we already know that the fraction of the superposition which sits in the top part of the hypercube is exponentially small. So the two processes, whether we are running the process on f or g, will look very similar to each other. The adiabatic algorithm is unable to distinguish between the two. Right? So this is really, how we capture this picture where we have this, where a monotone function represents this large basin. And now that was f. And then we added in this little piece g, this little piece where g differs. And f really, and the adiabatic algorithm just cannot notice the difference. Okay, so to formalize this fact, okay, so remember, we are using the adiabatic algorithm to minimize g. And now we are assuming that there exists a monotone function f, which is close to g, in the sense that it's equal to g except in the topmost few levels of the hypercube. And we're also claiming that the minimum value of g occurs at 1 to the n, at the string 1 to the n, so the opposite end of the hypercube. Then the claim is that the minimum gap is exponentially small in the eigenvalues. So the proof of this goes as follows. So let's look at h sub g of tau, the Hamiltonian at time tau that we apply for the adiabatic algorithm. So let's write this in we're going to write this in a rotating basis. So the basis that we'll write it on in depends upon actually this monotone function f. So we look at h sub f of tau. So suppose we were applying the adiabatic algorithm to f instead. And suppose we diagonalize that Hamiltonian, right? So let's write h sub g of tau in the same basis in which f gets diagonalized. Okay? So let's call the resulting matrix A of tau. Now, when tau is equal to 0, A of tau is, of course, diagonal because f and g both get diagonalized. So we are just at the initial Hamiltonian, which is diagonal in the Hadamard basis. So f and g are diagonalized by a common basis. And so at time t equal to tau equal to 0, the minimum eigenvalue, the ground state, lies at 0 to the n. Right? Because that's how we selected the initial state. Now, at tau equal to 1, both f and g are diagonalized in the computational basis, or in the z basis. So again, at tau equal to 1, the ground state now lies at 1 to the n. So it sits at this opposite corner of the matrix. Right? But in general, of course, A of tau is not going to be diagonal at general values of tau. But now what we're going to do is we are going to construct a new matrix B of tau, where we take this first column and row of A, and we are going to zero out everything except the diagonal entry. Okay? So I claim that in doing this zeroing out, we are not changing the matrix by very much. And the reason we are not is because this is where the ground state of f sits. But we know that the ground state of f is monotone, right? So the ground state of f is monotone. It doesn't see much of g, right? The difference between f and g. So if you were to take away the off-diagonal entries from this row and column, you're really crossing out an exponentially small amount of stuff from here. And so A of tau minus B of tau is exponentially small. But now we can look at B of tau. It's block diagonal, and so we can look at the ground state. You know, we can look at the minimum eigenvalues of this first block and second block separately, and plot them as a function of tau. Well, we know that the first block is where the minimum eigenvalue state lay initially. So the eigenvalue of this first block starts off low and ends up high. The second block is where the final ground state lies. So its eigenvalue starts high and ends up low, right? But these two must meet somewhere at some critical tau. But now we can say, well, if we compare A and B, well, then wherever this critical tau was, the minimum two eigenvalues of this matrix cross, but the minimum two eigenvalues of A therefore must be very exponentially close to each other because that distance is bounded by this norm. Okay. And that shows that there exists a critical tau where the minimum two eigenvalues of A must be exponentially close to each other. Okay, so now just to finish up with showing how this applies to 3-sat, what we'll use is a critical 3-sat formula, which is h hat of x1 through xn, which is just the AND over all triples ijk of xi or xj bar or xk bar, negation of xj and negation of xk. So if you plot out the number of unsatisfied clauses in this formula as a function of the Hamming weight of x, then you see this degree, I think it's a cubic polynomial. And it achieves its maximum at 2n over 3. And the two satisfying assignments are all zeros and all ones. Okay. So now, if we want to rule out the all zeros as a satisfying assignment, we just have to modify this formula by also insisting that either x1 or x2 or x3 is true. So now the only satisfying assignment would be the all ones assignment. Okay. So I'm going to claim that the adiabatic algorithm, the gap is exponentially small for this particular 3-sat formula. So the way you show that is well, f is a monotone function. So the number of satisfying assignments here is a monotone function. And what we're going to do is define a new function f, which just is a monotone continuation of this on this, for Hamming weights between 2n over 3 and n over 3. So now we have just changed g of x on an exponentially small part of the domain and made it monotone. So now the claim is that the adiabatic algorithm is going to behave as though it was pushing down to the all zero string, even though the solution lies at the all one string. So again, the gap is exponentially small. We finish up with a couple of open questions. So the first open question is to try to extend this to other NP-complete problems, such as Max Clique, and also such as 3-sat, where each variable occurs only in a constant number of clauses. So this turns out to be something that would be interesting from a physical viewpoint. So what is it going to take? As far as I can see, what it should take is somehow, this intuition that a large basin with a local optimum and a narrow basin with a global optimum. So somehow this is this kind of structure that we want to embed in these other combinatorial structures like 3-sat with constant degree. And possibly generalize these structures to include many local optima. So things get fairly complex there, and this is really going to take some thought. Although philosophically, I think it should work somehow along these lines. A second open question is the best speed up that we know in this model is quadratic. So the second open question is there a super polynomial speedup that we can get out of this formalism? Or could it be that there's a quadratic simulation of adiabatic quantum computation by classical computers? Thank you.
Questions? Right in the back there.
Yes. So the adiabatic. What I was doing was there's some function g that I'm trying to minimize, where the minimum of g occurs at the all one string, but.
Jumps from this
month before the last for all the months. How are you expecting to be different from college students?
This is a continuous process, right? So we are continuously changing the Hamiltonian. And what I'm doing is I'm comparing the Hamiltonian corresponding to the adiabatic process running on this function g that we are trying to minimize to an adiabatic process running on some artificial f, a monotone f that I cooked up for the purposes of the proof. And the only claim is that somewhere along the way, there must be a small gap for this, you know, when we are applying the adiabatic process to G. We don't know where this gap is going to occur. And actually, in numerical simulations, it occurs somewhere in the middle, you know, somewhere between 0 and 1. I'm sorry? Yeah. Yes. Yes. I should say that there was some sort of physical intuition that Fari et al. Referred to, which said that somehow in certain systems the gap should go down as 1 over the volume of the system, which in this case would be the number of qubits. So another interesting issue is trying to extend these results to those systems where there's some intuition saying the gap is 1 over the volume, and seeing whether it actually does turn out to be that or not.
Right here.
Right. So the answer to the first question is really that that's where the light was. We chose a single optimum because that's all we could prove. Right, so we'd like to be able to analyze situations where there are many local optima, because that's really the general situation. But it just turns out, you know, it was really we really didn't know how to follow the ground state or how to characterize it. So the point of this proof was that we really did not know how to follow the ground state. We didn't know how to compute it. All we could do was compute a certain property of it. We could characterize a certain property of it, namely monotonicity, and that was sufficient to bound the eigenvalues. In the case of many local minima, I still believe that some sort of refinement of these techniques would work. So often what happens with, for example, with 3-sat with bounded degree, the structure looks like this, that there still is one, you know, if you smooth out the function, then there's one sort of local minimum with a white basin. But with jagged pieces along the way, so there are lots of local minima. And so, you know, if one can smooth out this result and say, well, roughly it's going down towards the minima of that basin, that would be one way to extend these. But we don't know how to do that yet. Yeah. Yeah, we don't know how to make that statement.
Right.
Yeah. No, we don't know. And so the interesting thing in Grover's in search was that we knew exactly where the gap was small and how it varied. So we could actually explicitly compute the gap as a function of tau and tailor the schedule appropriately. Here we have no idea what the schedule looks like. The other point is that I think that somehow in general I wouldn't expect this sort of using a variable schedule to save more than a quadratic factor, say, some polynomial factor. And so if you are trying to distinguish between polynomial time versus exponential time, I don't think that's going to save that.
Okay, well, perhaps in lieu of time, further questions can be asked afterwards. Let's thank the speaker one more time.